We live?
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome back to our Q&A time. And I have one point of clarification to make in what I said about the FDA approval of the Comirnaty, and that is they based it on the original studies, and they did look at some of the community surveillance studies of the experimental, when I said no new studies originating double, but they looked at some outcome studies of the experimental, and they added that in. But other than that, everything I said was right. First question. I love your ministry. Thank you for being a voice at this time. Where can we find information regarding your open house, new building, fellowship meals you offer occasionally? We live in California and would like to come and visit class sometime. Thanks. I would just email Francesca at our request at and tell her you'd like to be included in those announcements that come out for our local group, and we can put you on. We have a worldwide email list, and we have a local email list, and if you want the local, we can put your email on the local, and you'll get those local announcements. My husband does not believe in Ellen White and is asking for biblical evidence that Jesus needed to develop a perfect character as the remedy for our salvation. Would you please help me provide this? Yes, Hebrews 5, 9 and 10. If you read it, it says, once he was made perfect, he became the source of salvation for all who obey him. Once he was made perfect, wasn't he always perfect? And this is what we go through. So Bible perfection is not about sinlessness. He was always sinless. Bible perfection is about maturity of character. And once he was made perfect, and it says in Scripture that he grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man, that he had to grow up as a human being, be tempted on all points like we are, yet without sin, and develop a perfect sinless human character. And once he did that, then he became the source of salvation. So Hebrews 5, 8 and 9, or 9 and 10. Your blog about the King of the North and the King of the South says Daniel 11, 29 through 39 transitions us from literal Israel to spiritual Israel. Could you please explain how these verses do that? I'm struggling to see the connection. Thanks. So you have to take that that prophecy in light as you read the whole blog. I start out and show that Daniel is a series of prophecies. Different imagery, but it repeats the same time frame. It starts with the metal man, and it goes into the multiple images, and it goes into the goat and the ram, and it goes into then the kings of the north and the kings of the south. But all of them are covering the timeline from when Daniel had his vision, when he was alive, started with Babylon, and then later it started with Medo-Persia, because he's in the Persian kingdom then, so Babylon's already gone, okay? But it starts wherever Daniel is, and goes all the way down to the second coming. They're covering the same time frames. And so all of the prophecies have a transition from literal Israel, and they have that transition, and you read it in the 70 weeks prophecy where the prince of the covenant is cut off, and it's in the kings of the north and south prophecy, Daniel 11, it also talks about that when the king or the prince is cut off or wounded or sacrificed. And so that is the transition point from Christ's crucifixion and after his resurrection, and in 34 AD, the gospel going, the dispensation to the Jewish people to fulfill their mission was over, and it went to the Christian dispensation, where the Christian church now carries the promises of evangelizing the world and preparing the world for second coming. So that's just understood to be there. And if you read I went back and read those verses again today, and if you read the context in mind, you will see that there in those verses 29 to 39, you'll see the papal power arising and persecuting the saints, and it corresponds with other prophecies like Daniel 7 and other places about the little horn power. Why did God need to create light and darkness on the first day? Isn't he the light? I suppose he, when he leaves the earth to heaven, there is darkness. Would God need to create Sabbath for Adam and Eve if he was accessible to them in the garden? So a series of kind of different questions there. My understanding is that, if you read Genesis 1, that there was already darkness on the earth covering the face of the deep, and the Lord came and he separated the darkness from the light. So it wasn't that he created the darkness that was there at that moment in time. There was already darkness. Isn't that what it says? Okay, the earth was void and without form, and darkness covered the face of the deep. Yeah, and then he separated the darkness from the light. So he created light. And that separation of darkness from light can have both literal meanings, that he created physical light at that moment. One way to understand that is there was a black hole in this corner of the Milky Way, a deep black abyss where no light was traveling, and that he dissipated the black hole so the rest of the light of the Milky Way was able to travel in this part of space. That's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is the spiritual aspect, that the war in heaven had already begun. Satan and his angels were cast out of heaven, it says. And they were cast to the earth. And why were they cast to the earth? Because there was a challenge over who was the rightful one to rule. And Lucifer was alleging equality with Christ. And God never wins by claims and declarations. He always wins by evidence. So Lucifer is cast out and to the earth. And the earth is a deep void, black pit with nothing. And God says, okay, Lucifer, you claim equality with my son. Show us what you can do with the earth. It's a big nothing. And there's darkness over the face. There's darkness now, not only of the black hole, but there's darkness of the lies and the misrepresentations of Satan. And then Jesus comes, let there be light. And he begins to show that, hey, Lucifer and I are not the same. I am a creator. I can speak things into existence. He cannot. And so he separates the light from the darkness. He separates the truth from the lies. And so there's other ways to understand that as well. And then create the Sabbath for Adam and Eve. In the context of this war, after giving evidence of his power, God created a day that demonstrates his character. And the Sabbath is evidence, not simply a power. Days 1 through 6, God has power. Day 7, I rest. I rest my case. I stop using power. And so what does it mean in the context of this war about whether we should trust and follow God or not, and for follow Lucifer, Satan, that God, instead of exercising power to coerce, compel, conscience, force, bend the knee or else, instead he shows his magnificence and his design laws in creating a planet where everything runs on the law of love, and then he rests and says, hey, no pressure, no coercion, think for yourself, come to your own conclusions. And it's about liberty and freedom and truth. And so the Sabbath was the evidence of the character of one who wields it, that we actually have liberty and freedom with God. So it was a gift to us, and it's a gift to us to exercise all week long as we remember the Sabbath all week long. We remember those methods and principles and how we practice them and how we treat others. When using teeth brushing to explain the seven levels of moral development, you note that at every level there are still teeth being brushed. However, when it comes to the Sabbath, there seems to be a big difference between resting on Saturday and presenting the truth in love and leaving people free. Am I missing something here? I like the way you present a deeper meaning of remembering the Sabbath. However, when you explain keeping yourself holy part. So yes, you cannot keep the Sabbath one day in seven. Why? Look at the Jews who crucified Christ. They rested from their work, and they were so fastidious about it that they had all these rules of things. They had to pin their handkerchief to their clothing because they couldn't work and carry it on Sabbath. They were very, very particular about not working on Sabbath. Were they Sabbath keepers? They were Sabbath breakers. Because Sabbath isn't ultimately about the day you cease labor. Sabbath is about the character that you have and how you live out God's principles. So in order to be a Sabbath keeper, you have to have the law written on your heart and mind. Truth, love, liberty, and how you treat others. You present the truth and love, and you leave other people free. And you practice those principles all week long. You don't coerce. You don't compel. These are true Sabbath keepers. And so you become a sign or an evidence of God's kingdom as you carry out. And certainly, I absolutely appreciate the seventh day because it's an opportunity to exercise your trust and faith in God every 7 days as you're looking forward to that time, that vacation in time, to put away the stressors, to come and fellowship with like believers, to be with family, to reconnect with God. And as you've left the Sabbath, you're invigorated, having had a rejuvenating experience. And then, you're going out thinking about what just happened this past Sabbath. And then as the week comes along, you hit hump day. You're looking for the next day to come along. And it's kind of like, I don't know, it's a metaphor now, but if anybody remember those old Tarzan movies, and he's like swinging from vine to vine, okay? You know, we're like swinging from Sabbath to Sabbath. We're reconnecting with the Lord every 7 days to energize us, to give us that peace and keep us focused to continue to live those principles through the week. So that's how I see it. It is not a legal process. But if you do it legally, that will have a different impact on you that is not actually developing of the Christ-like character. How would you explain the need of Jesus developing a perfect character to save us to someone who doesn't believe in Ellen White? I thought I'd just explain that. So, okay. When did Satan get a rebellious heart? Well, it was in 457,000 B.C. On a Tuesday. I'm not trying to poke fun, but the idea of when he got a rebellious heart, it says in heaven, if heaven is perfect, how did Satan get tempted to rebel? No, he wasn't tempted to rebel. It says in Ezekiel chapter 28 and Isaiah chapter 14 that he was perfect in all his ways until the day that sin was found within him. There is no excuse and there's no justification for Satan's rebellion. If you can excuse it and explain it and justify it, then it makes it right. Justify makes it right. There's no right to it. It was complete wrong. There's no basis for it. And that's why it's called the mystery of iniquity. There was nothing that would have caused him to do this other than he became infatuated with himself. You could say he stopped looking to God and the Father and started looking to himself. But that's really the core of it. Linda.
There's a group of people, and movies included, who seem to think there's balance needed in the universe. That you have to have evil in order to balance good.
Yeah, that's Eastern philosophy, and it's Satan's worldview, and Satan wants the people to believe that there will always be the existence of eternal good and eternal evil so that he exists for all eternity. Right. But, yeah, it's not true. Let's see. If it comes to being forcibly treated or relocated to another location for the common good, what are your thoughts on self-defense? Well, let's see. Peter used a sword and whacked off an ear. Sure, he was aiming for the ear. You think maybe the guy ducked at the last minute? Jesus told him to put away the sword. I've been reading a lot in Ellen White this past couple of weeks about this, and she says that that the temptation of character is going to be that you're going to be tempted like Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel. And you're going to be faced with the question, do I allow fear and survival drives to govern my actions such that I'll be willing to hurt others to protect myself? Or will I trust God to protect me and I won't use those actions? It's a character question and a solidifying and sealing the heart into the Lord. So at this time, she says repeatedly that God will send his angels to watch over and protect for those who trust him. But we will be placed in situations where we'll be tempted to use our own means and methods to protect ourselves. So in this particular case, I don't think it's godly or righteous to use the power of force to hurt others to protect yourself on these types of questions. That doesn't mean that force can't be used in a typical police practice to restrain those who are seeking to murder or molest or rape or pillage. We do use physical force to restrain the act of evil. But when it comes to the final crisis, Ellen White describes that they will have government authority and government mandates, and they will be coming with the force of the police and the military and whomever. And she says that God sends his angels to protect, and that ultimately this is the final movements right before Christ comes, and that the righteous will have their faces begin to light up as they trust him, as Moses' face was lighting up coming off the mountain. And then the voice is heard from heaven announcing the moment of Christ's return. And the wicked's weapons fall powerless, and they flee because of the radiance of God coming from our face. So I don't think it'll be necessary for us to use physical might to protect ourselves ultimately in the end. Where can we laymen go to research the truth on the lies being presented to the public on medical statistics? Appreciate your input on it. Also, what key words can we use to search Ellen White on these subjects? So, you know, I would tell you that the blog that I wrote a couple of weeks ago about COVID and the death of the independent American physician has a whole bunch of links there that take you to reliable sources. You can also do your own research, but at the end of the day, You don't have to know all the statistics to know the methods being employed. And at the end of the day, you can tell the godly from the ungodly by the methods. Do they want to censor or are they open? Listen, I have never advocated for silencing the people who are telling the other version of things. Let them tell it, but let the people who have a different version tell their version and let the truth win the day. That's the principle of God. If they're using methods where they have to censor and have to silence and can't tolerate opposing views or evidences, then you should be have a red flag go up that there's something wrong with their position. Will Christians be around when the plagues fall on those who have taken the mark in Revelation 17 and 18? Because that happens in Revelation 13 where it says that those who have not taken the mark will be beheaded. So my understanding is, and this is this is the question of the tribulation, pre-trib, post-trib, and mid-trib. And our view, on my view, is that in fact the Christians are on earth at the time of the tribulation and they're not taken off the earth. I don't really have any argument with people who see it another way. My view has always been it's not a point to fight over or a sword to die on. And if you hold the other way, praise God, as long as you practice God's methods in our life, when the day happens, we will all figure out which was right. As long as our hearts are right with the Lord, it's fine. But my view is that we will be here when the tribulation and the plagues begin to fall. And that's our last question. Any questions for the room?
No, but I do want to say in Egypt, the believers, so to speak, got the first several of them, but then they were protected from the last several plagues.
Okay.
So there could be a precedent there, where as the plagues get worse and worse and worse, you'll see a division between who's affected by them and who isn't.
Yeah, and part of this, I mean, so Ellen White writes that the full plagues don't fall until after probation closes. However, there is a loosening of the four winds before probation closes. And the loosening of the four winds allows the difficulties to start happening in the world. And the loosening of those four winds, I think we're in right now. The four winds are loosening. You see all the things happening. And the purpose in that is to wake people up. If you haven't understood, and this is where I'm so frustrated with our church leadership, this COVID crisis in the world is a perfect opportunity to bring the final message. The whole world is asking what's going on. What's the issue? And we have an opportunity to give the final message to the whole world, to stand up for liberty and conscience and not coerce and not compel and give the principles of God and the lifestyle message that protects and so forth and so on. We have a better message. But instead, we're aligning ourselves with state powers. We're advocating the same principles as the state, and that's because many people in church leadership worship the same God of Rome. An imperial dictator who makes up laws and injustice requires that dictator to use power to kill the wicked in the end. And when you have that type of a God, then you become like that God and you think the exercise of just authority to coerce and compel people is righteous, and it's not. And we should be protected from it as an institution and as an organization because we have such beautiful wisdom and writings in the writings of Ellen White that give us a different view and a different perspective. But that message was rejected in 1888, and our church has been wandering the wilderness ever since. So we are advocating for historic Adventism, for the real message that's going to prepare the world. Yes?
All right, just a simple statement on the timeline. I just remember what Ellen White said. She said the whole of Daniel 11 is yet to be fulfilled. So in her life, Daniel 11 had not actually been, you know, still yet to be in the future. That's what lends me to believe what you have shared about the King of the North and King of the South, was because it was yet from her life into the future.
Okay.
If the COVID vaccine is not that good, why is it that now the people that are in the hospital that had the vaccine aren't dying as opposed to the people that didn't have the vaccine? Statistically wise, that's what they're saying.
Now, I don't know the data. I'd have to look at the data. I haven't seen the numbers. I don't see how. What are the numbers of actual people dying right now?
95% unvaccinated.
But what's the actual numbers? Are we losing 1,000 people a day? Are we losing 20,000 people a day? Are we losing 100,000 people a day? So this is the other thing. Let's say in the hospital in America with 350 million people over the next month, 1,000 people die and 75% are unvaccinated. So these numbers are not actually comparing apples to apples. The vaccinated have a treatment. It's not a completely effective treatment. As I said, 42% effective on the Pfizer and 67% effective on the other two. But they have a treatment that gives them some protection. The data shows if you do early treatment within the first 5 days, you actually reduce hospitalization and death 86%, better than either vaccine. So the people that are going in the hospital are people who have had no treatment. They didn't get a vaccine, and they didn't get early treatment. Now, why didn't they get early treatment?
I can tell you why. I got COVID. I was sent a letter from the local health department that said, and I quote, there is no treatment for COVID.
Right. So the health department says there is no treatment. And so the health department informs the local doctors, and the health department gets that from the CDC and the NIH, and the CDC and the NIH has perfectly put out a policy that if somebody gets COVID, you send them home and don't treat them until they become in respiratory distress. This would be like somebody with stage 1 cancer, and you tell them, go home until it metastasizes to stage 4, and then come for treatment, and we'll hit you with big doses of chemo, but most of you are going to die. And that's what you're seeing in the hospital. You're seeing a lot of people dying that are unvaccinated because the actual government is misrepresenting the disease state and advocating for one intervention and one intervention only, and that's a vaccine. And they're purposely artificially magnifying the number of deaths. According to the data, multiple studies show this now. 650,000 deaths in America if they've done the early treatment, which has been out there for over a year in published articles, you could reduce that number by 86%. Okay? So this is the bigger point. You wouldn't have all those people in the hospital at all if you would actually do the early treatment and doctors were educated. I will tell you, most doctors in Chattanooga do not know about early treatment. Pardon? There are a few that are starting to get it and start to do it, but some of the doctors that are doing the early treatment are now being targeted and being threatened that their medical practice might be and their license might be revoked for doing early treatment. Think that through. We're going to give treatment that has essentially no risk of harm compared to your recommendation to go home and do nothing, that the data science shows multiple articles, 86% reduction, but you're going to take my license for doing a treatment with 86% reduction of hospitalization and death, but you're not going to take the license of all the doctors who do nothing and let people get into respiratory stress and go to the hospital and die.
There's also so much shaming going on of people who are unvaccinated that they are scared to go to an ER, and by the time they go, if you don't treat it early, it's unsuccessful.
That's right. You have to start the treatment in the first 5 days of symptoms to get the biggest reductions. Because my understanding of how this disease works, the first 5 days you're getting rapid viral replication in the body. You intervene then, you can reduce the viral replication. After the viral replication phase, you get the inflammatory cytokine phase. And after the cytokine inflammatory phase, that causes end organ tissue damage and blood clotting issues to occur. And it's the end organ tissue damage and blood clotting issues that causes the death. And so after 5 days, you go to the hospital, you've missed the opportunity to stop the viral replication, and you're already in the inflammatory phase that's starting to damage the tissue and cause the clotting issues. And so that's why they're having really bad outcomes. And so it's really bad medicine practiced by, what I said in class, authority-based decision-making. The CDC has said, the NIH has said, the health department has said, and we don't think we mindlessly follow what these guidelines say in spite of the actual reproducible evidence. And this is why you're seeing this. So it's an artifact of bad policy, and you should ask, why is this bad policy being persisted? And why is it that so many organizations like Facebook and YouTube and Twitter and all these major media outlets complicit in silencing voices that could save millions of lives? Yes?
You referred to this article, or a short letter actually, from this Adventist medical person.
Mm-hmm.
It's very reliable. Oh, I happened to read it before John did, and I said to him, you know, I was commenting. And John said, well, does he give references, you know, like Tim does? And so later when he read it, he said, he's just saying that 90% of the beds in the hospitals are of non-vaccinated individuals with COVID. He said, how does he know this 90%? I mean, he didn't give a reference or a statistic or anything like that.
Yeah, so again, yes, lots of statements made, not always referenced, but also he didn't, I'm sure, stratify those unvaccinated. How many got early treatment according to the protocols and how many didn't? I will bet you almost all of them didn't. And you should ask him at the head of Loma Linda University, do you have all of your physicians instructed in the early treatment protocols to aggressively start early treatment with somebody who has symptoms in the first 5 days, or do you tell them to go home and wait until they're in distress and then come back and then you hospitalize them? It's bad medicine.
With the Delta virus that's going on now, part of the people in the hospitals are vaccinated and they've got that.
Yeah, I don't know what the exact statistics are. Again, the Pfizer vaccine, 42% of the people are protected and don't get infected, and 67% with the others. But those numbers are falling. It's not going to stay 42%. It's not going to stay 67%. It's going to fall. But the healthy lifestyle, the vitamin D, the fresh air, the plant-based diet, those aren't falling. Those stay. You get those same benefits with the healthy lifestyle. So, and the people who've recovered already and have robust immunity, the data shows that that does not fall either. You maintain a robust immunity. And on the couple of cases, there's like maybe two or three cases in the world of people who have recovered who've gotten reinfected. They had a very mild case that's more like the common cold when they got reinfected. So it's extremely unlikely to get reinfected, but even if you do after you recovered, it's not life-threatening. It's very mild.
The Dublin Convention Center set up for the monoclonal antibodies. If you get that early treatment.
That is part of early treatment, and I would recommend people go ahead and do the monoclonal antibody, but that's not all you should do. Go to my website, go to that blog I told you, scroll down, early treatment. There's multiple links there, multiple ones, studies you can see. There's actual protocols in the one from the American Association of Surgeons and Physicians and Surgeons. It actually is a home-based protocol, and you can actually print out a sheet, take it to your doctor, and educate him on what needs to be done. It's really good. Let's close with prayer. Gracious Father in heaven, we thank you again for the methods and principles that you live and operate your universe by. We want to be part of your kingdom. Give us the wisdom on how to discern, how to make healthy decisions, but ultimately how to treat other people, leaving people free and loving them even if they don't see it our way, and not using coercive practices to force people against their conscience because it's damaging, Lord. And we long to see you come soon. We pray in your holy name. Amen.